This is The Bible Show. Welcome, folks, to another episode of The Bible Show. My name is Sam, and joining me today is Will, and we are continuing our series in the book of Exodus. Today, we're going to be in Exodus 11 and 12, but before we get there, we have an ask that we would like to make of you that I think would be helpful. So every year coming into January, we get a lot of people who are like, I would like to read the Bible.
Yeah.
And where they go through it and they race through it. Our pastor likes to talk about it like almost like, you know, if you're doing daily readings and you're going through the whole Bible, that's a wonderful thing to do. But it's almost like fast food where it's like, you know, you're not pulling out the full meaning of it and you're racing through. If you have somebody that is coming into the new year that is looking for a New Year's resolution that they want to get to know the Bible better, we like, and he refers to this more like fine dining, like spending time. And to walk through all of our episodes in Genesis would take you a while. There's a good number of episodes, but you're really going to understand Genesis better than if you're flying through it with daily reading. Mm-hmm. So what we want to ask you to do today, if you like the content that we've had so far with Genesis and Exodus, and you know of people that are looking for a platform or a plan to go through the scriptures, refer the show to them. You know, share it with them. Maybe go back to Genesis 1 and share that episode and be like, you know, here's a Bible study that I think would really benefit and bless you. And encourage people in your church, people in your community, your family members to do that. That would be a big help to our show and all of our algorithms and sharing and everything else. So that's our ask for the day. Anything you want to add to that?
Great ask. We just know people do want to read the Bible when it comes to January. And one of the reasons we decided to do Genesis was to align with that.
Like, yeah.
We want to help people that are just first time engaging with the Bible. Because most reading plans, no matter how crazy it sounds, start in Genesis. Because it is the beginning. But it is a wild book to get through if you have no other resources to help you. And we would love to be that resource for them.
Yeah, I remember when my mom started reading the Bible. She gave up because she couldn't make sense of it. She couldn't put together, like, what is this trying to teach me? And so to have somebody like everybody, you and I had people who walked us through and taught us. And like it's not like we understood this on our own. So having somebody to walk you through the story to really understand it is more beneficial to you in the long run than just racing through it and not understanding it, right? Either way is great. I commend anything that gets you in the Word. But if you appreciate this style, do that for us. So we are continuing in Exodus 11 and 12. So we get into today the last of the plagues, the most devastating of the plagues, which is
the death of the firstborn.
The death of the firstborn. And then we're going to get into Exodus chapter 12 as well, which is the celebration of the Passover feast, which is considered the great feast. There's so many times in Scripture where God refers to himself as the God who brought you up out of Egypt. Like, he takes this on as kind of an identity marker for himself of the kind of God he is. He's the God who leads out. He leads people out of their slavery from the land of death. And so, interesting thing about this, and it's important to remember this as we're going through this plague today, because it's jarring. Like, we go from plagues in the beginning, if you remember the first triad, where it's like, oh, they're kind of minor inconveniences. Like, I wouldn't want to have frogs everywhere, but my life's not over or devastated with frogs.
I'm not that affected.
Yeah.
Forever.
Lice and gnats, like, I don't enjoy it.
But they'll go away eventually.
But they'll go away. And, you know, bugs and swarms, like, I don't like that either. But, like, as the plagues go, they get worse and worse and worse until you get to this one, where this one would have been devastating. Yeah. Like, this one would have been probably one of the worst things that could befall a person. But here's one of the things that's important to remember. You go back to Exodus 4 when God first called Moses. What did God say to Moses that he was to say to Pharaoh before this whole contest got started? Exodus 4, verse 22, it says, "Then you shall say to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, Israel is my firstborn son." Which, the one that you've been killing all the babies, the one, my firstborn son that you've been oppressing, my firstborn son that you've been so harsh to, and you will not let go. I'm saying to you, let my son go that he may serve me. And if you refuse to let him go, what does God say? Behold, I will kill your firstborn son. And so this has been hanging over Pharaoh's head from the beginning. This is not a surprise. Assuming that Moses was faithful to tell him, like, this, before the very first plague, this was out there. And Pharaoh just keeps pushing God. No, yeah, I dare you. And he keeps oppressing his firstborn son, Israel. And so when we get to this plague, this is not capricious. It's not without a massive amount of patience where it's been months of these plagues.
How long is the plague cycle, would you say? I know it's not, it's hard.
So we know that, like, the first plague lasts 7 days. And some of them, it'll give you a day count. We know that from when, like, the barley harvest to the wheat harvest, we know that it's months, right? Okay. So as this, it's at least a few months. Some people put it more than that. But this is like, they've been sitting in this. Time has not elapsed. Yeah, it's not like he hasn't had time to settle his thoughts of everything that's happened. He's been sitting in this, imagine this, months of realizing that you were utterly defeated and outmatched and overpowered, knowing that this, the final threat, has been hanging over your head this whole time. God has made good on every other promise that he's put in front of you, and you haven't been able to stop it. And yet you're still so egotistical and so absolutely determined in your own pride to stand as a fool against this God that you endanger every single firstborn son in all the land.
That's interesting, that perspective of the ego, because you are thinking, okay, he knows this is the last plague. Mm-hmm. He doesn't know how many there are. So every time he pushes, every time he says, Moses, not this time.
Yeah, he's gambling.
That's crazy.
Every single time. Maybe next time this happens. Maybe next. And he's so egotistical and pride driven.
He thinks this will just go on forever and won't come to.
That's right. I can't. Even though he's got to realize by now that he's every time he loses. And he loses exactly according to what God says.
And it's getting worse and worse. You have to think, okay, what's worse than what just happened?
Right.
It sure seems like this. The algebra equation seems like death of the firstborn.
And the other thing, like, you go through the plagues like we have. All the gods are gone now. There's
what's
just
left. Yeah,
there's one God standing, and you know who that is?
Pharaoh himself.
And it's like, you got to be doing the calculations, like, what's left, what could happen, and yet his ego cannot get out of his own way. And we think that's crazy, but how many times in ministry have you looked at somebody who's like, how do you not get it? How do you not realize that your life is in utter destruction because of the choices you're making or the conflict that you're in? And people are like, I refuse, I will not apologize. I will not humble myself. And so they just keep throwing their life deeper into destruction. And they know the costs only get worse as time goes. Like, does that sound familiar?
And we're all guilty of that somewhere.
So bad. We're all just stupid sometimes when it comes to this. But that's Pharaoh's, like, he is personifying all of those traits.
And maybe it is just when you have kids that you see. Like, now I'm looking at a little girl who... who is amazing. I love her and she's a blessing, but she's stubborn. I'm like, oh, this is what stubbornness and humanity look like. But it's been a real mirror into my own heart, being like, oh, there's a lot of that in me.
Yeah.
I've learned to hide it. I've learned to masquerade it. I see it sometimes, but it's more than I think.
And as parents, what gets a rise out of us when our kids are stubborn is it meshes up against what we want, you know, a lot of times. Some of it's godly.
Yeah.
But a lot of it's like, you're messing up my schedule. Yeah, like,
I want my way and you're not letting me get my way.
That's right. Yeah, it's just, we're all self-absorbed. And that scriptures are helping us see that. So jumping in verse 1, it says, the Lord said to Moses. So to understand this, because this could get a little confusing. And the last of where we just left off, the last part of the last chapter we looked at, you had this exchange between Pharaoh and Moses where it's like, you will not see my face again. And Moses is like, deal.
Gotcha.
You're not going to see my face again. And I don't care because I don't need you. And then you're going to see, like, later on, I think it's verse 4, it jumps in and Moses is back talking with Pharaoh. So if you don't understand that verses 1-3 are parenthetical, so it's like Moses is talking to Pharaoh. God intervenes and it's like, this is what God told Moses for 3 verses, essentially. And then it's the conclusion of the conversation that Moses was having with Pharaoh in the last chapter.
Oh, so this is just a bad...
Yep.
Where we put the chapter later on is not a great place.
Correct. So see 1-3 as a parenthesis. Like, Moses is having this out with Pharaoh. God comes to Moses as speaking to him, whatever, as they're in the middle.
Okay.
This is parenthetical. So the Lord said to Moses, yet one more plague I will bring upon Pharaoh and upon Egypt. Afterward, he will let you go from here. When he lets you go, he will drive you away completely. And so this plague is going, every other plague, Pharaoh's tried to negotiate. I'll let these number of people go. I'll let the old people go. I'll let the men go. You can't take the livestock. his negotiating muscles are, this plague is going to break all of them. So one more plague, and then he's going to drive you away. Notice the word completely. Nothing is going to remain behind. So verse 2, speak now in the hearing of the people, that they ask every man of his neighbor and every woman of her neighbor for silver and gold jewelry. And the Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, which is kind of a weird thought. Why would the people have favor? It's that natural human instinct for the underdog story, like, and a hatred for what Pharaoh's done. Because remember, everybody's turned on Pharaoh. Even his own inner circle now is like, what are you doing? Egypt's ruined. What are you doing? And so the more he drives himself deeper into wickedness, the more appealing these people over here look, the more you understand, like, you're clearly the bad guy, Pharaoh. And so now all the people are looking at them like, you, I hope you win, you know, because this guy's an idiot.
And this is the only healthy time to align yourself with power because it favors you. You know, usually we do that in life where we just want to be with the powerful selfishly to get something out of it, which is sinful. But this is one where it's like, oh no, you should align yourself with God because you've seen his power. That's the whole goal of this.
Yeah, that's right. And they do. And so listen to this next, because this is kind of wild. Moreover, the man Moses was very great in the land of Egypt. That's like the Hebrew, like exceedingly great. So these are kind of terms that are usually reserved for Pharaoh. No. He's over Pharaoh. He's exceedingly great. And notice who it is. In the land of Egypt, in the sight of Pharaoh's servants, and in the sight of the officials. So you put Pharaoh next to Moses, and all of the Egyptian people are like, Moses is exceedingly great. His officials, Moses is exceedingly great. Pharaoh's been utterly humiliated next to Moses, and now Moses is the undisputed spiritual champion of Egypt. Pharaoh looks like a fool, right, to everybody. And so here you have God coming to them and saying, I want all of my people, before they go, to go out throughout all the land of Egypt, because they love you now. They're actually like rooting for you. You have favor with them. And ask them, like, gold, silver, clothing, can you help us because we're about to go free?
Yeah.
Can you spare some stuff that you have? And what's the condition of Egypt at this point?
It's decimated.
Decimated. Like,
there's livestock, there's no land, there's nothing.
So now, out of this level of decimation, you're going to be like, oh, we've got some extra gold and silver and clothing. And I was like, this is kind of interesting. So nerding out, I go and I start looking at why would you clothing and gold and silver? When you go into 18th and 19th dynasties of the pharaohs and you look at their writings and their, you know, tomb paintings and everything else, this is the offerings that you give to the gods. So like, Ramses III has a papyrus called Harris I papyrus, and it says, quote, they carried to her silver, gold, and fine linens. That sound familiar? Many other things as numerous as the sand, and offered them before her, the goddess. Never was the like seen before kings began to reign. Or you'll see that clothing is in this, gold is in this. You'll see this in chapter 12, silver's in this. And so now the Egyptians are giving to the Israelites gifts that are usually reserved for either Pharaoh, because he's seen as royalty and divine, or
the other gods.
The gods. So this is like a massive statement here. And so when God says that they're going to ask for these things, that word ask in Hebrew is sha'al, which comes from the same Hebrew root as shalah, which is let my people go. In other words, you're going to sign over all your stuff, right? I'm going to ask you for it. You're going to give it over. Pharaoh's going to give you over to God. So the Egyptians, from Pharaoh down, everybody is signing over. Like, get out. Here's our gold. Here's our silver. Here's our clothing. Here's your slaves. It's all signed over. It's deeded over. Go. And so you have this massive voluntary transfer of wealth that was promised, even going back into Genesis, when Abraham promised that this would be the case, that they would leave with great plunder and wealth, right? And so then, so Moses has heard this. Verse 4, Moses said, Thus says the Lord, about midnight, I will go out in the midst of Egypt, and every firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on the throne, even to the firstborn of the slave girl who is behind the handmill, and all the firstborn of the cattle. In other words, it's saying from the highest to the lowest, even the cattle, there shall be a great cry throughout all the land of Egypt, such as there has never been. And the word great cry there, which is in the Hebrew, is the same expression that you found in Exodus 2.
Oh, when they're crying out to God.
When they're crying out. Because remember, Pharaoh, the god of the Egyptians, throwing babies in the Nile. Severe oppression. And the Hebrews are giving a great cry. And now God has come mercifully, repeatedly, patiently, begging Pharaoh to do the right thing. That doesn't happen. And now Egypt and Pharaoh are going to be the ones who give the great cry. And interestingly enough, like in archaeology, in the tomb of the Pharaoh that I think is the Pharaoh of the Exodus, which is Amenhotep II, he has one child buried in his tomb with him. And it's a Prince Webensenu, who died unusually early, still as a younger Pharaoh to be. And then verse 7, it says, but not a dog. And now, so death is going to be everywhere, right?
I have one question about who
the
firstborn is. Is it like just children? Like my brother's the firstborn of our household. He's still the firstborn, even though like we're not under our parents' roof. So are adult men dying?
I don't know. I think that's the case, but I don't know for sure if that's intended. Like if you get married and you have kids, are you like off of the hook now or is it firstborn?
Yeah. Are there 60-year-old men dying because they're the birth order of the firstborn?
So the interesting thing is when you're putting together, like we did an under the hood video on which of like, who is the Pharaoh of the Exodus is kind of the point of that video. And we know that Moses disappears from Egypt when Pharaoh tries to kill him and he's out in the wilderness for 40 years. There's only a couple of pharaohs that reign that long because remember it's when Pharaoh dies that God comes and says, go back to Egypt. Mm-hmm. The ones who sought to kill you are dead. So a 40-year period, there's only a couple of pharaohs that works with. And Thutmose III, sorry, you scratched the nerd.
I didn't know this was where it's going to head, to be honest. I'm shocked you managed to fit this in at that question.
So but follow me. So Thutmose III is going to be the pharaoh he runs from. Now, the next pharaoh is Amenhotep II, who's not a firstborn. So when the plague of the firstborn happens, he doesn't die. So but we know that his older brother dies. Right. And doesn't.
That's interesting. Yeah.
So then he died prematurely. And then we also know that his firstborn son dies. And so in that particular time period, we know that two firstborns of the Pharaoh die, which is interesting.
Cause that changes it's terrible, devastating to lose a child. But if you imagine being a woman and losing your husband and your child in a moment.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That would be
just population density too. Like,
yeah,
half of the men are firstborn.
Yeah,
like,
you know, it's so. This would have been shocking. I mean, all of Egypt is devastated here. And then verse 7, it says this weird line: "But not a dog shall growl."
Yeah, it's weird.
Okay, so everybody just starts dying. Like, why tell us? But not a dog shall growl against any of the people of Israel, either man or beast, that you may know that the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. So when I used to read that, I would think, okay, that means that nobody's going to be mad at Israel. Like not even a dog is going to be like, you know, looking at the Israelite, you know, upset, and Egyptians aren't going to blame the Israelites. I think that's part of it. But listen to this. When you go and you read ancient Egyptian stuff, dogs, for whatever reason, are seen as the guardians of the dead. So like if you go and do a Google search of the god Anubis, what does Anubis look like?
A dog.
A dog. It's a jackal. It's always on top of the burial boxes, the canopic shrines where they put all the pharaoh's bodies and organs and everything else. On top of it, during these dynasties, you always see Canopus, which is a jackal. Why? Nobody better come and steal this body because Anubis is the guardian of the dead. You come and you try to disturb the dead, Anubis is going to get you. Oh, you know, like, don't you dare come near the dead. You also had another Egyptian god, Wepwawit. It sounds like Elmer Fudd saying something. Wepwawit, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, who is the god of funeral rites that had the head of a gray wolf. And so when you get to dogs, they were seen as scavengers. They're always going around through the burial stuff. Like there's writings about that. So now I want you to hear this. If Anubis and this Wepwawit, can't be right. I don't think it's right either. But anyway, if they're the gods that guard the dead, not one of them growls, which means what? They don't care.
Or they can't do anything.
They can't do anything. They're not upset. They're not guarding the souls. There's a hint of like eternal judgment because Anubis was the one who led you through the hall of judgment to your final destination. So like not even, they don't care. Mm-hmm. All this death, all this misery, everything else. And Anubis and Wepwawit, I got to stop saying it. they don't even utter a growl. They're not upset about this. Not even a little bit. So that would have sent a message. Verse 8, it says, and all these your servants shall come down to me and bow down to me. In other words, all your people, Pharaoh, are going to finally be done with you. They're going to come whether you send them or not.
Yeah, it's over today.
They're done with you. And they're going to say, get out, you and all the people who follow you. And after that, I will go out. And he went out from Pharaoh in hot anger.
Nice, Moses.
So now Moses is like,
he's got a little fire.
Yeah, Pharaoh tried to get hot with him. Moses turns around and leaves in hot anger.
That's true. We have to remember Pharaoh did yell at Moses right before this.
So. Yeah, Pharaoh's a punk. So he vows, remember, never to see Moses' face again. And Moses is like, yep. And even after this, we're going to be told that when Pharaoh says, get out of Egypt after all the suffering and everything else comes, he sends his servants. It'll say he summons them, but he sends his servants to be like, get out.
Yeah, yeah.
Get out. And so he will never see them again. So verse 9, it says, then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh will not listen to you, that my wonders may be multiplied in the land of Egypt. So here comes the Lord. And even like, it's just wild Pharaoh's heart here, because even after hearing that all the firstborns in Egypt are going to be dead, including his own, that they're all endangered, Pharaoh ignores the fact that there was a way out of this, because what would he have to do before this?
Set the people free.
I don't want that. Like, go, please, yeah. Go, get out of here. Take everything. He ignored the 9 plagues that God had imposed. He ignores his own officials begging him to allow the Israelites to go free. He ignores the fact that his economy's just in shambles with every refusal only getting worse. And he has absolutely no credibility or respect that he has to protect from the people. They look at him as a fool.
Yeah.
Now he's terrible. So verse 10, it says, Moses and Aaron did all these wonders before Pharaoh, and the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, which hang on to that interesting word here, and he did not let the people of Israel go out of the land. Okay, so we talked about hardening before.
Yeah.
You remember what it meant earlier on?
Like it's judgment.
Judgment. It gets weighty. Halls of judgment. His heart gets heavy. It's going to weigh more than the feather. He's going to be judged by Amut, right? All that stuff. That's not the word here. So it goes from having that root of kaved, which means heavy, or kavod, that means heavy. And now this word is at the same translated hardening, totally different Hebrew word, except this time it's hazak, and it means to strengthen or repair. And so You're going to see this word, not the heavy word, show up after boils and locusts and darkness. So when you get into the later plagues, this word begins to take over, and it's not the same as making stubborn or making heavy. It's strengthening. So you imagine somebody who's been just totally defeated, right? They're in shambles. And then they get like a second wind of anger and they're going to be strengthened up again. Hmm. That's the meaning of this word. Like it's hardening yourself to say, no, I'm not going to give up. I'm going to harden myself. I'm coming at it again. That's the idea behind this. And so in the majority, this word's used 291 times in scriptures, and it's the majority of them are translated as strengthened, right? So like a perfect example of this, remember what happens to Samson at the end of his life? Yes. He loses his strength. He gets his eyes gouged out. He's mocked and put in between two pillars. And what does he pray? He says, I'll read it to you real quick. Then Samson called to the Lord and said, O Lord God, please remember me. He'd lost all of his strength when his hair got cut, but he says, remember me and please strengthen me this one more. That's the word. I've been made weak. I've been decimated by what's happened to me. Help me rebound. Help me to find my strength one more time. That's what's happening with Pharaoh. And this, it's like, he's like, I'm just decimated by a plague. But then he's like, I'm not giving up.
And he can't show weakness.
And so he's strengthening himself. That's the idea. So it's like, I remember when I was a kid. And this is like stupid Pharaoh, but it's like the human experience. I remember when I was a kid and I would be in class and I would do something stupid and the teacher would be like, that's a detention. And what do?
Just flew off the handle.
Well, I mean, scream, maybe not yells. Fly off the handle, but it wasn't like, oh, I'm so sorry, my bad, you know, humble myself.
Wrong, yes.
It was like, no, he was talking, or blah, 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 blah. And then the teacher would get annoyed with me because I refused to give it up, and I was an attorney over everything, and a kid that I wouldn't want to teach.
That's the most annoying thing ever.
I was that kid. So anyway, then the teacher would be like, you keep going, you're getting another detention. So what does Sam do in all his wisdom?
Keep going.
You just keep going. That's another hour. And then what do I do? Keep going. That's another hour. That's another hour. And it's like, that's what's happening here with Pharaoh. It's purely the strength of egotistical rage when you know you're finished and you just keep pressing in knowing it's going to get worse, but your ego can't allow it. You have to at least pretend that you're still in control, even though everything around you is decimated.
Yeah, he has to pretend he's still winning this battle.
He's a 2-year-old. He's got the mind of a toddler. Like, that's, I remember that. Getting grounded and talking back to my dad, that's another day. Yeah, like, and just keep going. And it's like, you know you're an idiot as you're doing it. You can't help yourself.
No.
So that's what Pharaoh's doing. We get to the end of Exodus chapter 11, jumping into 12. And this chapter is going to be largely about the Passover. So here he's announced the judgment. Now here comes the path of salvation. If you don't want the judgment to happen to you,
there's a way.
There's a path. There's a way of hope here that you need to embrace. And as we're going to see, not to be too much of a spoiler, who is the Passover available to?
Everybody.
Everybody. Not just Israelites. Everybody is allowed to celebrate this. So if you're an Egyptian, just remember when the hail happened, what does God say to the Egyptians? If you don't want to
get your stuff inside.
Get inside. And you'll be fine, right? So he gives them a path out. This, he gives a path.
The real test of wisdom is, do you ever think you would be the Egyptians believing, like, being like, oh, man, I should probably just bring my guys inside just in case there's hail.
Yeah.
Or like, hey, the Israelites are putting blood on their doorposts. Like, we got any? Like,
yeah.
Maybe it seems to be working out better for them.
What's the Pascal's wager? You know, like, even, isn't it better to just give your life to Jesus just in case? Yeah. I mean,
it doesn't work like that, but
yeah, it doesn't. Like, it has to be a full heart but surrender this way relationship. But in this case, put some blood on the door. Like, and by the way, like you said with the other plague, this would be a public profession. Like, this house is his. It's marked permanently. And so, starting in verse 1, it says, the Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, this month shall be for you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year for you. And so, in the Hebrew religious calendar, this is going to be the month of Nisan. This is where you're going to find Passover, the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And God is doing a work because in this, when the lamb is slain and they come out of the land of death and all this stuff, God is making all things new. Sound familiar? Everything is going to be a new covenant, a new beginning, a new nation, a new calendar. All of these things are going to be made new. And Jesus, what happens? You find all the new stuff again, right? New creation in Christ. That's 2 Corinthians 5:17. It's New Jerusalem. It's a new earth, new heavens, new earth. It's all of these things being made new. That's what happens when God does a big movement of redemption. Things are made new. It's really cool. So verse 3, tell all the congregation of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, every man shall take a lamb according to their father's houses, a lamb for each household. Stop there for a moment, because we're in the Hebrew religious calendar. No idea what that means. It's a 360-day calendar. They throw in an extra month every once in a while, like a leap year kind of thing.
Okay.
Like where they have to make up for the calendar to keep it on par with ours. But anyway, with this, on the 10th day of the month, so the 10th of Nisan, they bring the lamb into their home. Now, there's something in history that happens that's very interesting that ties this in a picture with the gospel. Do you know what else happens on Nisan 10 when you get to the New Testament? When Jesus comes into the city of Jerusalem, right? Palm Sunday, he comes in and everybody's Hosanna, you know, here comes the one who's saving us. They're all attributing their salvation to him, you know, shouting out. This is Nisan 10. Palm Sunday's Nisan 10. What do you hear in that? Here comes the Lamb of God.
Into the city.
Who's coming into the great city where he's going to be slain. And he's introduced into Jerusalem on Nisan 10, Palm Sunday. Interesting correlation. Hang on to that, because that pattern just keeps developing. So if the household is too small for a lamb, then he and his nearest neighbor shall take according to the number of persons, according to what each can eat, for you shall make your count for the lamb, right? So take a lamb, bring it into your house. And so, interesting, they're going to keep it in the house for 4 days, as we're going to see. Verse 5. By the way,
that just seems like it makes it so much worse.
It does.
This lamb becomes your friend.
But that's, I guess that tracks point. With the Jesus. Yeah, the Jesus.
That's the point. So that last verse, when it says that it's your congregation, tell all the congregation of Israel, the first time that word is used. So it's not just a nation. And I think what God is doing when he says a congregation, like he said, he's stressing that this deliverance is coming from a rise in worship, not some political revolution.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, go tell your...
The nation state of Israel, got it, but the peoples of Israel, the religious worshipers.
The congregation, which is kind of interesting. So verse 5, it says, your lamb shall be without blemish. And so this word that comes, we've talked about this word before, tamim, it means like perfected. It's fully matured. It doesn't have any defects. It's used for Noah when it talks about like when God chose him, he was blameless. Mm. That's the idea. It doesn't have any obvious defects where people are like, oh, not that one. That one's a mess. So take a lamb without blemish. What do you hear there? Gospel-wise. Yeah.
Jesus, perfect.
Jesus is perfect. He's without sin. There's no fault in him at all. So here you have the unblemished lamb that comes into Jerusalem on Nisan 10, a male, a year old, which means it's reached adulthood as a member of the flock. You may take it from the sheep or the goats, which is interesting that goats are allowed. And it says, and you shall keep it to the 14th day of this month, which means when this lamb or goat comes into your house, guess who's with it all the time?
The whole fam.
The whole family. If you brought in a goat or a sheep into your house with your kids, how would that go?
It better be to save our lives, because that's the only way a sheep or goat is entering my household.
Yeah, that's
better have a good argument for Morgan to say, hey, this has to be here for 4 days, or one of our kids is donezo.
So your preschooler daughter, how do you think it would go?
We didn't do so hot at the last petting zoo we were at.
Oh, no?
Nothing big happened, but it definitely was not. No, I don't think no, the Bushman like, blood doesn't like... petting zoos.
No cuddling.
Farm
like,
animals. Oh. No.
Like, get this thing away.
Like
it smells.
Anything past a dog, we're like,
all right, well, some children.
I'm sure most children would grow fond of said animal in your house.
Yeah, that's right. You come with any animal and it's like, can we keep it? Can we keep it? Can we keep it? And so now for 4 days, you're growing accustomed to this. There's a soft spot in your heart. Why would God do that? Because you know where this is going.
Sacrifices are sacrifices.
It's a real sacrifice.
Has to cost.
It's not like me going and finding a lizard and being like, oh yeah, here's a lizard. You know, it's like, oh man, we named it.
Billy,
you
know, Billy like, the goat's dead.
That's right. This is going to actually be something I have to surrender. That is a reminder that my sin comes at a cost, that something really did have to pay. And so it says, when the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill their lambs at twilight. So after 4 days, you're going to sacrifice these lambs, and they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts, which is the sides of the doors, and on the lintel top over the door of the houses in which they shall eat it. And so you start tacking on, okay, we've got what's going on here, a lamb that is introduced on Nisan 10, the lamb that's going to be slain on Nisan 14. What's Jesus doing for 4 days after he comes into Jerusalem?
Just out there with the people.
He's being examined. He's giving hope. He's drawing people to himself. Some people are going to weep like crazy when he's sacrificed because he meant the world to them. And you see, and he's without blemish and he's male and all of these things. He's like, man, this is what Paul calls him later on. This is really is the Passover lamb. He's what, you know, John the Baptist referred to as the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. And so another interesting thing about this is they're going to do these sacrifices right in the middle of Egypt, which remember the whole point of this is like, let us go so that we can go out in the wilderness to make a sacrifice to the Lord our God. And Pharaoh's like, no, you're going to do it here. And what's Moses' response? We can't do that because the Egyptians see this as an abomination. Like, we can't do that, right? That was the fourth plague when the response is that. But now they're doing these the sacrifices right in the middle of Egypt.
Well, because the Egyptians have no power or control anymore. No one's afraid of Pharaoh and the Israelites
That's right.
anymore.
They're totally done. I mean, you see how as this story unfolds, the Israelites are more and more in control. They have confidence in their God. They're not afraid of their enemies anymore. Hint, hint, like, walk in that, right? and they're confident and safe to do exactly what the Lord commands wherever he commands it. And so there's a weird myth, because I was looking, like, where does the, would the Egyptians have heard anything with the blood on the doorpost? There actually is a weird Egyptian myth that's written after Moses. And I'm not going to tell the whole Egyptian myth because it's like wild. Somebody was on drugs when they came up. Yeah,
they're hard to keep track of.
With these, they really are. So in this myth, there's Pharaoh has a wife who like had somebody who she had a relationship with. That guy got exiled, ultimately killed, comes back as a bull. This is called the Tale of Two Brothers in Egyptian mythology. He comes back as a bull, and Pharaoh's wife recognizes this is Bata, who is the guy. And so she has him slaughtered, and he shakes his blood onto the doorpost of the palace that births two Percy trees. This is written 200 years after Moses. And then she demands that the trees be cut down because she sees the spirit of Bata in the trees. And as they're being cut down, a splinter from the tree flies into her mouth. She gets pregnant by Bata, the tree now, and then gives birth to what they think is the authentic Pharaoh, who then takes the throne away from the evil, wicked Pharaoh.
Okay.
Weird that there's another myth about. So, but think about that.
There's a myth about everything.
In the Egyptian mindset, the blood on the doorpost is associated with somebody who took away the power of Pharaoh.
Yeah, an evil king losing power.
That's right. Which is, I just think is interesting. Crazy myth, but blood on doorpost is not something that's common.
Not written everywhere.
But think about that. It becomes something that the Egyptians write about two centuries after Moses would have been there. So verse 8, they shall eat the flesh that night. So he lays out, like, this is what the Passover meal is going to look like. Much simpler than it'll be in the first century when there's a lot of traditions added on. This one's super simple. They shall eat the flesh that night roasted on fire. So roasted lamb, unleavened bread, and bitter herbs they shall eat. And so you get these three things, and all of them are foreshadowing Christ. And all of them are instructive to what they've just gone through, right? So let's pause here for a minute. Roasted lambs. What do we learn in that? You have to take a lamb, slaughter it, roast it, and then you're going to eat it. What do you hear in that?
I mean, you're eating that lamb at the end.
You're eating the lamb. Why did that lamb have to die?
For your safety.
For your safety.
For your life.
For your life. Something else had to die for you to live. So God, in one of the greatest and first and greatest deliverance of the Old Testament, this is it, right? Something has to die for you to live. Hint, hint. And by the way,
something that did nothing wrong.
Yeah, it's up without blemish, right? Everything is good about that. You're the one that caused something to have to die. And then, by the way, it's going to be the shed blood of that lamb that marks your house that then delivers you from death. So apart from the blood, and by the way, all of them would have died. If nobody in Egypt, Israelite or Egyptian, had put blood on their doorpost, who dies? Every firstborn, which means the Israelites, their firstborn deserved death. God would have been just if all of them died, right? And yet, it's only by the blood that they find deliverance from death, right? So if an Israelite didn't put blood on the door, they're open to the curse. If an Egyptian doesn't have blood on the door, they're open to the curse. The blood is what saves, period.
Yeah, not their blood inside of them.
Yeah, and it's nothing, exactly right, good. Yeah, it's not their bloodline that saves them. It is the blood on the doorpost that God commanded from the innocent lamb that was slain. Mm. Hear that, right? Do you hear that? It's not, they can't compromise. There's no deeds. There's no qualifications. Even Moses had to do this. If Moses didn't put this on his doorpost.
That's wild to think about. I never thought about that.
Gershom's gone. He has to do this. It's the blood that spares even him. And so the only reason anyone gets mercy is found in the blood. And when the New Testament comes along, what does Jesus say? So they're eating this roasted lamb. John 6, verse 53 and 54, Jesus says this, "Truly, truly, I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood," that's weird, "you have no life in you." What's he saying there? Like, I am the roasted lamb.
Yeah.
I was the one who was put to judgment so that you can live. If you don't consume me, you have no life. "Whoever feeds on my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up on the last day." And so Jesus will be betrayed. He'll face trial. He'll be condemned on the night of the Passover meal. That's no accident. God, in his sovereignty, is writing these two train tracks that are parallel. And Jesus is accomplishing something way greater than Moses ever dreamed. Hmm. Like, not just an earthly death, an everlasting death he is sparing you from by the power of his blood. And when on the night of that Passover, he takes the cup, and it says, Luke 22, verse 20, the cup that is poured out for you is the new covenant in my blood. You know what he's referring to? They would have totally understood this right away. In Jeremiah 31, Jeremiah is looking back at the Passover and what God did to deliver the Israelites, right? On this very, very night. And listen to what Jeremiah says. And Jeremiah is writing about 600 years before the Last Supper, right? Okay. After the Exodus, before the Last Supper. And he says, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant. What did Jesus say the wine is?
It is the new covenant.
It's a new covenant in my blood for the forgiveness of sins, right? Behold, he tells Jeremiah, I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, not like the covenant I made with their fathers. And he's talking about the fathers of Moses' day. On the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. When is that? That's Passover. So the new covenant, Jeremiah is saying, God is like, not like it was when I took them by the hand and led them out of Egypt on Passover. My covenant that they broke, though I was their husband, declares the Lord. And so here you have Jesus saying, you know what Jeremiah was talking about 600 years ago when there's going to be a new covenant of, you know, da-da-da-da-da?
Here it is.
It's my blood that's going to be shed for you. It's Passover blood. This is the blood. This is the blood that delivers you from death. Take it. It's the only path out. It's the only way you find life. And so then, so you have the roasted lamb and all that comes with that. But then he says the next part of the meal is unleavened bread. What in the world is that? Why?
It's bread without leaven.
What does leaven symbolize? All through scripture.
Well, sin.
Sin.
In the Bible.
So often in the Bible. So I'll give you, Jesus says to avoid the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees, Matthew 16, 6. He says, to avoid the leaven of Herod, Mark 8, 15. He says, do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump, meaning like a little bit of corruption will spread throughout the whole bread and make the whole thing leavened. And that's 1 Corinthians 5, 6. So here you have Jesus who's saying leaven is sin, essentially, and part of this meal is unleavened bread. So if leaven represents sin, what kind of bread is this?
Sinless bread.
Sinless bread. What does Jesus refer to himself as?
The bread of life.
I am the bread of life. On the night of the Passover, what does he do? He takes the bread, and it says, Luke 22, 19, he took the bread, and when he had given thanks, which is wild to me, because what does this bread represent when he breaks it?
His broken body.
I'm going to be broken for you. Mm. I'm going to suffer for you. And what does he do as he's doing that? He's giving thanks. You ever think about that? How wild that is?
Just because we give thanks before meals, just kind of out of just rot. That's what we do.
But think about him being like, I know what this represents. I know the cross is coming. I know that I'm about to be broken for you. And he's giving thanks as he's doing it. Lord, I'm so grateful. And he breaks this, knowing what that represents. And he gave it to them saying, this is my body, which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. And then you see all these powerful examples of like the Emmaus disciples. It was in the breaking of the bread that they recognize him. There's something powerful in the breaking of bread. And Jesus is going to say, truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls in the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. So the whole, he's like inviting you to recognize that even the story of wheat itself is a picture of the gospel. That seed has to die for life to come forward. And Tom, do you remember when our pastor, do you remember when he explained how the creation of bread follows the pattern of the gospel?
Of course, I remember everything he's ever preached.
Dutiful son-in-law right there. So anyway, think about this. The wheat has to be cut down, which is...
It's killed.
It's killed. It's crushed. It's pressed. It's then placed in waters, right? Which is a nod to baptism, death, and suffering. The dough is then pierced to make sure that it doesn't bubble up in the oven. So bread with yeast or leaven, what happens to it?
Bubbles up, becomes fluffy.
Becomes fluffy. Do you know why leaven is equated with sin? Think about it.
Blake didn't like the fluff, I guess.
No, it puffs up. What is sin? The root of all sin is what? Pride. It's puffing yourself up, right? And so the idea of bread, like unleavened bread is almost like crackers. It's flat, right? But leavened bread puffs itself up. It tries to make itself look more substantive than it is. And so for them, they were like, that's sinful bread. trying to make a big deal out of itself, pride, arrogance, all that stuff. That's why it's, you know, considered like the emblem of sin. And so the dough's pierced to ensure it doesn't bubble up in the oven. And by the way, if in the case of Jesus, yeast is artificially added to the dough, like he takes on the sin of the world, which then causes the rising, maybe? No? All right, anyway. The dough's thrown into a fiery oven, striped from the grates that hold the bread in the oven, and then after being taken from the oven, it's broken and shared and provides strength and life from within to all who partake of it.
Okay.
You go with that?
Yeah.
A little artistic.
Yeah.
Take some license
A lot
there.
Of thought about bread, but yeah.
It's not thus saith the Lord, but it's there. All right. So a lot of people, when they get to the Passover, also one of the things that points to Jesus is the Afikoman. Have you ever heard this whole
I've
deal?
Heard it.
Passover. So at the beginning of a Passover meal, which is like the Christians celebrate Easter when the resurrection of Christ is kind of the equivalent to the Passover. They happen pretty much in the same part of the year. At the beginning of Passover, there's three matzah or unleavened bread cakes, right? And so the middle one at the beginning of a Passover, so if you're a Messianic Jew or a Jewish person, you have three loaves. It's what they did in the first century. Jesus would have done this. The middle piece is taken and it's broken, and the smaller piece is put back in the stack, and then the host wraps up the larger piece, and he'll take it and hide it, and he doesn't let the kids see them when they do that. So during the Passover, they read through the Passover story. They're drinking different symbolic cups of wine. And then near the end, the children, there's a contest where it's like, okay, go find the larger piece of the middle bread, right? And so they run around, and the first one to find it comes back, and they get a prize, and it's the last thing you eat. And so the idea is when Jesus takes out the bread and breaks it and says, this is my body, right? What piece is that? You know, a lot of people will say that's the Afikoman, and the body is broken, buried, returns, concludes the meal. And as the Passover is going, this is also, to me, kind of interesting symbolism. There's four cups of wine, right? You drink the first one as a nod to sanctification, that God has set us apart as you're going through the meal.
Okay.
You drink the second cup, and it's Jesus taking judgment upon himself. It's all about deliverance. You drink the third cup, and it's about redemption, right? So Jesus redeems us through his blood, and at the Passover, there's a fourth cup, which is restoration and praise, right?
Okay.
When Jesus lifts up the cup, listen to what he says, because it's the redemption cup. It's cup number three. He's going to lift this up and say, drink of it, all of you, for this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. And then listen to what he says. I tell you, I will not drink again of this fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. So if he says that after the third cup, what does he not drink?
The third cup.
He drinks the third cup, but he doesn't drink
the fourth cup,
which is about what? Restoration and praise and everything being brought back to what it's supposed to be. He's waiting until we're all joined up again to the heavenly wedding feast of the Lamb. Then he's going to celebrate this and bring a conclusion to that great Passover that began at the Last Supper, but he withholds that cup until we're together again. And so in some sense, Jesus is still fasting, waiting for that fourth cup to where we can be restored with him again. And the heavens and the earth are made new, but he pauses after that third cup of redemption, the cup for the forgiveness of sins, and says, I won't drink the fourth until we're together again. Which is kind of cool that Jesus is holding off, waiting for us.
Yeah, waiting for the true feast, yeah.
Ever think of Jesus up there waiting for you?
That's interesting.
Waiting for his church, like he's actively fasting, waiting.
Yeah, like he's withholding something from himself.
Yeah.
Because he cares to do it with us.
Yeah, there's a metaphor in that for, you know, dating and engagement, having to withhold what you want until the marriage comes.
What are you talking about?
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
It's good.
Trying to take me down an awkward road. But I mean, yeah, abstinence until marriage, there's a sense in which Jesus is not giving. He's withholding. Until that day.
Till his bride.
Yeah, which is kind of cool. So the last piece is bitter herbs. And so there would be a dish of bitter herbs that represented the bitterness of their centuries of slavery. Today, which would have been the first century model, the Jews have three different dishes that you dip in during the Passover. So the first one is the bitter herbs. Usually it's, have you ever had a Seder dinner?
We did one when I first got here.
Yeah,
but that was a long time ago.
Do you remember what they use for bitter herbs?
No.
Horseradish. You ever open up a horseradish?
I don't, because I don't like it.
It's gross. It's really gross. And there's people who claim to like it. I think they're lying. But anyway, I used to, when I was teaching this back in the day, I probably did this with your class where I had a jar and I would open it and put it in front of the student's nose and tell them to take a big whiff because it will stun your senses because it's powerfully bitter. So anyway, that would be one, the bitter herbs. Then they have a dish of salt water and vinegar that represents their tears. And then they had something called caroset, which is fruit and nuts and a pastry mix that's like the mortar of the bricks that they had to make in their slavery. But it represents like a sweetness in the sorrow.
Yeah, that's
the
idea. Good.
That is good. That's the only thing that's good about that part. But the bitter herbs were one of the dishes required in Exodus. So now think about all these sovereign little nods that you're finding in the story of the Last Supper. So you've got the cups, you've got the unleavened bread, the roasted lamb. But now John 13, verse 26, this is when Jesus is going to refer to this dish. What are the dishes on the table? Bitter herbs, salt water, tears, and then the mortar brick stuff.
Chutney thing.
Yeah, the good stuff. So Jesus says, when he's talking about his betrayal, he says, "It is he to whom I will give this morsel of bread when I have dipped it." So when he had dipped the morsel, he gave it to Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot. And after he had taken the morsel, Satan entered into Judas. And Jesus said to him, "Do what you're going to do. Do quickly. What you're going to do, do quickly." So now I want you to imagine the symbolism going on here. You take the unleavened bread, the sinless bread of life, with a hand of Judas, the one who shares the bowl, and what is that going to be plunged into?
The bitter herbs.
So the bread of life is going to be plunged into the bitterness by the hand of the one I hand this to, right? And Judas is going to be the one who accomplishes that. Some real symbolism going on here. And he says in verse 9, "Do not eat any of it raw or boiled in water, but roasted." This is going to be something that faces the fires, which is what happens with an atoning sacrifice. Its head, with its legs and its inner parts, every part of this is going to be facing the fires. "And you shall let none of it remain until the morning. Anything that remains until the morning you shall burn. Don't leave it to rot. Don't leave it to spoil. This is sacred. In this manner you shall eat it. With your belt fastened, with your sandals on your feet, with your staff in your hand, you shall eat it in haste. This is the Lord's Passover." And so you're going to celebrate this Passover with a sense of expectancy.
And urgency.
You've never known anywhere that, like, all throughout your whole life, you've been a slave.
Yeah.
You've never been allowed to leave. You've never been allowed to do your own thing. And God is saying, not only are you going to eat it, I want you to eat it with your belt on and your sandals on. I want you strapped up, ready to go. I want all your stuff together, which if you're eating, you've never done that before.
Yeah.
Which means you're
going
to have
to. You're not going anywhere.
You're going to have to celebrate this, but you're going to have to be expectant. God is going to do what he says he's going to do, and we're going to have to leave in a hurry.
Yeah, so right away.
And it's not going to be like, "Oh, hold on a minute. Let me go get this and get this, and I forgot to pack, and I need to go settle my account with the whoever down the road and da-da-da." No, you are ready to go. You are expecting this. This is a sharp moment of decision. No lingering, no packing, no deliberating. It's go time. Like when the God says go, you need to be ready to go. And then verse 12, I love this because it kind of hits on what we've been talking about in these last few episodes. He says, "For I will pass through the land of Egypt that night, and I will strike down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and on all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgment. I am the Lord." So this plague is falling upon the gods of Egypt. All these plagues have decimated the gods of Egypt, including Pharaoh himself. And why firstborn? The firstborn always represents what? For a family, like?
The lineage, the line.
It's the lineage. It's the line. It's the future.
Gets more.
Yep, they get it because they're in charge of preserving the family and managing that and everything else. So they have to steward the greater inheritance. But it's the future of a family, a nation, a royal dynasty. And so he's like, all firstborn belong to me. The firstborn of the Israelites are dedicated to me when they're circumcised, right? So I get, and they're consecrated to me as firstborn. The firstborn of the Egyptians also belongs to me. But if it's going to be in defiance, then it's going to be in death. All firstborn belong to me. The question is whether or not they belong to me in life or death. Because they do belong to me one way or another, right? So these firstborn always represent the future. And this being a matter of faith, like, now that everybody's left the question, the same question we've had earlier, do you trust Yahweh or are you leaning on lesser gods?
Yeah.
Are you going to put the blood on the house or are you saying, I'm going to roll the dice again on this one? I think our gods are due for a comeback, which is crazy. But it'll be the ultimate expression of God's power over Egypt. And so here's another thing, by the way, notice in this passage, who is it that brings, don't look at your Bible. Who is it that brings death to the firstborn?
The Lord.
It is. Very good. Have you ever, like, I've always heard this taught, like, the angel of death. You heard that?
Yeah.
Nope. It's not the, because notice the language. I will pass through. I will strike. I will execute judgment. Who is it that's saying these things?
The Lord.
It's the Lord. So he is the one. It's not like some weird.
Who made up this weird angel of death? Because you're right. That's.
I think because people are uncomfortable with the thought that God would do this. Right? Like, maybe there's something out there that I'm not familiar with, but this is the Lord who is doing this. By the way, and he's also the one who comes and says, there's blood on that door. Nope, not going in there. That one doesn't have it. That one is facing judgment. So the blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you are. And notice, hear this, because this is so rich. When I see the blood, I will pass over you. And no plague will befall you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. So what is God looking for?
The blood.
Extrapolate that into your life. Yeah. Like, he's not coming to the Egyptian and being like, I need to quiz you on your theology and doctrine. You know, do you have the right, whatever? Like, he's looking for blood. Blood there, moving on. He doesn't go inside and say, I wonder what kind of behavior is going on in this household. Do you measure up? Are you worthy of me? Da, 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 da. He doesn't go inside. He looks at the outside. It's marked with the blood. Done. Moving on. Judgment's over. Like, you mercy is upon you, right? He doesn't come in and examine the magazines on your coffee table. The only thing that determines death or life is what? Again, just stress this.
The blood.
The blood, period. That's it. When I see the blood, I will pass over you. Put that on, you feel that. That's no different. Like, Jesus is our Passover lamb. Do you have the blood or not? That's it.
Yeah.
Like, if you have the blood, it will change your behavior. It will make you more sanctified. It will change who you are because the Spirit will animate your life from that point forward. But the entrance into the kingdom of God is determined by blood.
Yeah.
Period. You got to have the blood. The blood of Christ shed for you. Verse 14, this day shall be a memorial day, and you shall keep it as a feast to the Lord throughout your generations as a statute forever. You shall keep it as a feast 7 days. So now in the Passover, you also have this feast of unleavened bread that goes for 7 days. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day, you shall remove leaven out of your houses. For if anyone eats what is leavened from the first day to the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. So now he gives this spring cleaning, right? That's just where we get it from. Because when is Passover? It's almost always like March, April. Mm-hmm. What else? Have you ever heard of that before, spring cleaning?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's not like...
But I've never equated it to this, I'll be honest.
That's where it comes from.
That's interesting.
So in spring cleaning, what's because it's actually a pretty good exercise. The whole idea of going through your house and getting rid of the leaven, God's not going, no, not the leaven. You know, he's not freaking out about leaven as though it's some kind of a threat to him. But it's an exercise. Like, I want you to go systematically throughout all of your house looking for leaven. And what do you encounter everywhere you go? Like, this is everything in my house is what's represented in my life. When you're doing spring cleaning, you are seeing those things that you've stored up and where your treasure lies and everything else. And it's a time for you to take it all out, clean it, figure out whether or not it belongs in your house, and then moving on with your life. So spring cleaning initially was like, this is time for me to go through my garage and assess everything and look at whether it belongs here, whether it's warranting being here, and to purge your life of stuff. But you do that also as a spiritual exercise.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Just leaven. But it's like, you ever think about that? Like, I want to go through my life top to bottom and say, does this belong in my life?
I try not to do that, but I should.
That's the idea here. It's a once a year, week long, deep assessment of everything in your house. Mm. And you're to remove leaven. But what does leaven represent? And they knew this at the time.
Sin.
I need to get rid of anything that puffs me up, anything that takes away my distraction from the Lord. And I'm going to spend all my time doing this, not because God hates leaven, but because, or yeast, but because he hates things that puff themselves up against him. And I'm going to make this a deep personal spiritual exercise to get rid of bad priorities and forgotten duties and all corrupting influences, all that stuff I need to fix. So, and a failure to do this, so like you have the blood, but you don't take anything seriously. Well, even if you were in, you're cut off.
Wow.
Like, so.
It's real.
It's real. So verse 16 is going to be a long passage I'm going to read here. On the first day, you shall hold an assembly, and on the seventh day, a holy assembly. No work shall be done on these days. So like Jesus' trial, which is in the midst of these 2 days between Nisan 14 and Nisan 21, was illegal for them to do. Like they were not allowed to do this. It was supposed to be Sabbath. No work done on these days. They break the law to put Jesus on a cross. But what everyone needs to eat, that alone may be prepared for you. And you shall observe the feast of unleavened bread, for on this very day I brought your host out of the land of Egypt. Therefore you shall observe this day throughout your generations as a statute forever. In the first month, from the 14th day of the month at evening, you shall eat unleavened bread until the 21st day of the month at evening. For 7 days, no leaven is to be found in your houses. If anyone eats what is leavened, that person will be cut off from the congregation of Israel, whether he's a sojourner or a native of the land. You shall eat nothing leavened in all your houses and all your dwelling places. You shall eat unleavened bread. So
make sure it's unleavened, people.
It's big. And so the New Testament picks up on this, you know, and 1 Corinthians 5:6-8. You see that there? Mm-hmm. You read that? Listen to how much Paul is expecting us to understand the feasts and Passover and unleavened bread, because he equates Christian living with this exercise. So can you read this for us?
Yeah, he says, your boasting is not
boasting,
good.
Boasting, you mean puffing up like yeah. leaven causes?
He gets right to it. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Cleanse out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump as you really are unleavened. For Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. Let us therefore celebrate the festival, not with the old leaven, the leaven of malice and evil, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth.
So again,
brings it all together for us.
What is this feast supposed to do? It's not really about leaven. It's about malice, evil, sincerity, truth, making sure that that's what you're not puffing yourself up. That's the idea. And Paul's like, just in case you were confused, bam. Like, this is it.
He summarized it much quicker than you did, though.
Well, he's Paul, and he's inspired by God. Give me a break. All right, so verse 21, then Moses called all the elders. You're such a punk. Anyway, then Moses called all the elders of Israel and said to them, go and select lambs for yourselves according to your clans and kill the Passover lamb. Take a bunch of hyssop and dip it in the blood. Now, where else do you find hyssop in the Bible? Does anything jump into mind?
Psalm 51.
Very good. Yeah. So who says that?
David with his contrite heart. Cleanse me with a hyssop branch.
Yeah, that's right. It's like, so imagine a long stalk with like a bundle of flowers at the end. That's like a thick, so you can imagine almost like a paintbrush.
Getting whacked.
Yeah. So you're getting a lot of, so it's like cleanse me with hyssop. When Jesus is on the cross and he cries out, I thirst, what do the Romans do?
Stick some vinegar in his mouth.
But with a hyssop, right? So they take wine and gall or vinegar mixed up. They dip it in there, and they're literally, imagine this. So here's wine and hyssop, a little on the nose, right? That they're taking and they're applying to the one who said, I am the door, right? Boom. And they put it in his mouth, and he refuses to partake of it, right?
Because it's wine.
Yeah, that's interesting. I never thought about that. Yeah, maybe. Good call. So anyway, he won't partake of that, even though he's thirsty, and they're, you know, I think they're mocking him and trying to, some people say it was supposed to be a painkiller to enable him to suffer longer. I don't know. But anyway, it's interesting that the emblem of blood on hyssop is being put to the mouth of Jesus.
That is interesting.
In this whole reflection of the Passover. Verse 24, you shall observe this rite as a statute for you and your sons forever. And when you come to the land that the Lord will give you, as he has promised, you shall keep this service. And when your children say to you, what do you mean by this service? You shall say, it's the sacrifice of the Lord's Passover, for he passed over the houses of people in Israel, of Israel in Egypt, when he struck the Egyptians, but spared our houses. And the people bowed their heads in worship. So, like, you think through, like, you had the covenant of circumcision, but the first time where God's like, I want this to be remembered, everyone's going to do this going forward. Here's the next one. So circumcision, boom. Then you get Passover, which is like, this is a big deal to him. And it's not a once and done. This is generational. So, you know, we celebrate Easter as the completed Passover, right? The resurrection of Christ. So we're still celebrating it, even though we don't get into all the technical things. Most people don't do seders in Christian homes, which I think they're cool to do and to celebrate. But this is meant to be shared. God wants you. What? Smiling again. What? Anyway.
No, you just did a good job making sure that seders aren't, we don't think like they're sinful to do.
Yeah, no, no, they're wonderful. Yeah, so if you think they're if you think they're saving you, not great.
Yeah.
But as a way to honor God.
They're not a requirement, but if it's a fun way to go through the season, if that's what you choose to
do. And to see it through the lens of Jesus fulfilled all this.
Yeah.
Like, and that it exalts him. Absolutely. I think it's kind of cool to do. And so the phrase out of Egypt, like, I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. Like, God wants this story told. That's repeated 56 times in the Bible. I'm the Lord your God who brought you up out of Egypt. This is a big story for him. One of those memorial stones where it's like, I want them to know that I'm the God who redeems them out of the land of death and slavery. And so, but he also breaks it in two part, which I kind of, I think is interesting. So the kids ask, why do we celebrate this? And he points to two parts. He says, this is when he struck the Egyptians and spared our houses. What do you hear in that? Like, you're to celebrate that God smashed these evil enemies. We hear that modern day and we're like, oh no, we're not, we don't want to.
It's not just he spared our houses and then set you free.
Right.
The first part has to happen.
He smashes the enemies, right? So that's something that's worthy of celebrating God when he smashes enemies. That's okay. But notice the next part, because it doesn't allow you to get puffed up. He spared our houses, which what do you hear in that? To spare it means, apart from him, it was doomed, right? He showed mercy on us. We deserved destruction. We were on the path to destruction, but purely out of his mercy, he spared us. So it's not like we're better than our enemies. No, he smashed our enemies, and he showed mercy to us. We deserve the same fate. So anyway, personal take there. Verse 28, then the people of Israel went and did so. As the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron, so they did. At midnight, the Lord struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on his throne to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of the livestock, from the lowest to the highest, no exceptions for those outside the blood. Yes. Now, so verse 30, it says, and Pharaoh rose up in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and here it is, there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where someone was not dead. Then he summoned Moses and Aaron, and this is going to be, you know, sending people to them by night, and said, up, go out from among my people, both you and the people of Israel, and go serve the Lord as you have said. Take your flocks and your herds. So, like, I'm holding nothing back. I'm not trying to be in charge anymore. Go with all of you as you have said, and be gone. And bless me also, which is, you know, no more negotiations, everything. Go. I sign over title. You can belong to your Lord. Just get out of here. No, by the way, bless me, which means show grace on me, show favor to me. This is Pharaoh. Finally, he's crying uncle. Like, I can't stand anymore. Yeah. Like, I'm finally undone. Go, go. The Egyptians were urgent with the people to send them out of the land in haste, for they said, we shall all be dead. So the people took their dough before it was leavened, their kneading bowls being bound up in their cloaks and on their shoulders. The people of Israel had also done as Moses told them, for they had asked the Egyptians for gold and silver and gold jewelry and for clothing. And the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians so that they let them have what they asked for. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. And so in this, like, you've got the Egyptians are like, what do we have to do to help you? Here's our dough. Here's our gold. Here's our silver. Here's everything that we're going to go to. And in theology, I don't know if you want to get into this, but that expression, plundering Egypt, becomes something that's kind of like the early fathers, the early church fathers talked about this a lot, because there was questions about, like, okay, we're coming into the church, but all of society's obsessed with like Plato and Socrates and Aristotle and all these thinkers, but they're not biblical wisdom. They're not like straight inspired scriptures. Are we allowed to study the Greeks and the Romans that came before us that seem to have wisdom? Or is that like, you know, once it's in the church, like you can't do that because they're not authoritative.
They're not Christians.
Right. They're not Christian. And Augustine says it really brilliantly. He says, just like God allowed the Israelites to come out of Egypt with all of these things that were, I'm sure were earrings that were pagan associated, you know, but he gives over all the wealth of Egypt that then is repurposed to glorify him. And so there's the question, like oftentimes, like, you know, what books are Christians, you know, permitted to read? What worship groups, that's a big one that we get a lot as pastors. What worship groups, like if there's a worship group that gets into really kooky theology or does things that are shameful, or a, somebody who's a pastor who has this brilliant ministry with apologetics or whatever, but he has a fall, like, you know, I got a couple of names jumping to mind. Can you use their stuff anymore?
Yep.
Since they come from people who have clay feet or that are messed up, podcasts, movies, you know, if we say something that you disagree with, can you ever listen to the show again? You know, if we say something you think is dishonoring to God. And what Augustine would say is that if that support means you're dishonoring God,
okay,
like by actively allowing sin to continue by supporting them, then stop, right? But if you can plunder what they do and there's things that they've offered that are beneficial to your life that reflect truth and that you can take them and use them for the glory of God, plunder Egypt. Plunder Egypt. Like, feel free to do that because all truth is God's truth, right? It's not just, well, it's in Egypt, so it can't be. No, there's things that come out of Egypt or Greece or Rome that are beautiful and true and in line with the scriptures. All truth is God's truth. And so feel that freedom to plunder Egypt, right? And by the way, the silver and the gold and the clothing, they're going to be used to build things.
Yeah.
You know what they're going to be used to build?
Well, bad things in this story.
Bad things and good things. So they build a golden calf. It's not great. So you plunder Egypt. You used it for evil. Then it's evil.
Yeah.
But it's also used to build the tabernacle, which is going to be the dwelling place of God. God deems fit to live inside of Egyptian plunder, right? We are plunder of the enemy, right? He's plundered us from Satan's household. We're plunder, right? Once evil. But it's how it's then used that can become honoring to God. And so all, I live with grace in that stuff. Don't do things that dishonor God, but also don't be so...
Yeah, that's secular.
So tightly wound that you can't use anything. Because I promise you, if you could see my heart and how sinful I am, you'd be like, well, we never want to use anything that he does. You know, we're all fallen vessels. Like Moses is a murderer and we're reading his book, right?
Yeah.
So you, God can redeem that which is faulty, even from screwballs that mess up and even ones that are shameful and don't belong to him.
Yeah, I think a cool phrase that I, about this topic of like, what do we do with different kind of things is receive, redeem, or reject. Like there's some things from this world that we can just straight up receive. Like as it comes to us, take it and do it. There's some things that we do need to redeem, maybe ideas or values or whatever that is. And there's just some things that like, hey, as Christians, we are called to reject.
Yeah, that's good. I like that. So verse 37, it says, and the people of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, beside, that's huge, besides women and children. And so scholars estimate 600,000 men equates to 2 million when you factor in wives and children and everything else. And some have actually argued that this number, the word thousand, means clans. So it would be instead of 600,000, it's 600 clans, but that doesn't make sense. Like, I just want to put that down because why then add not including women and children?
Yeah, right? Because they don't have their own clans.
Like, it's not like it's a clan of women and a clan of children. That doesn't make sense. But a lot of fringe scholars argue that, but most Hebrew scholars reject that because I don't think it makes sense.
And anyway, that's just to really, they argue that just to bring down the number of people.
Yeah, because it's hard, like 2 million, that's a lot, you know? So verse 38, a mixed multitude. Whoa, like this is the beautiful thing. Here's the payoff punch right here. A mixed multitude, who's coming out of Egypt?
Some Egyptians, some other nationalities, lots of people.
Yes, other people put blood on the doorposts. Other people are coming out with them. There's a mixed multitude of Israelites and Egyptians and Nubians and other people who went up with them and very much livestock, both flocks and herds. So Egypt is decimated, but they're coming out with massive amounts of livestock and herds. And they baked unleavened cakes of the dough that they had brought out of Egypt, for it was not leavened because they were thrust out of Egypt and could not wait. So even the foreigners that are like, well, I would have had unleavened. It was too quick. They couldn't get the leaven in. So they come out with unleavened bread, nor had they prepared any provisions for themselves. And so it's this whole thing is interesting to me. Like, you get to the number of slaves bit, Egypt is going to be rid of all their slaves, right? What's interesting is the Pharaoh of the Exodus, right? And the records that you find in Egypt right after this time period, you have a Pharaoh that goes on a crusade and he gathers more slaves and more livestock than any other Pharaoh's records ever in the history of Egypt by a lot.
Just because he has to make up for it, right?
Right. It says that he went and seized horses and livestock without limit. 1,092 chariots. Gee, why would they lose all their horses? Why would they lose all their chariots? And then it goes on and it says 101,128 foreign slaves that they go into regions where they have control that are under Egyptian dominion and say, we're taking all of you as slaves. Suddenly, just massive, over 100,000 all at once, which is 46 times more slaves than all other campaigns when you combine them from this dynasty. So then the question is, why the sudden shortage of the livestock, horses, chariots, and slave labor?
They're all gone.
Right? And then you have Egyptologists that say right during this time period, there's cracks in the power of Egypt. So verse 40, that the time that the people of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years. At the end of 430 years, on that very day, all the host of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. It was a night of watching by the Lord to bring them out of the land of Egypt. So this same night is a night of watching kept to the Lord by all the people of Israel throughout their generations. So this is right on the day, to the day of 430 years of coming in. Verse 43, it says, and the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, this is a statute of the Passover. Now hear this, because you used to be like, wait a minute, what do we do with this? No foreigner shall eat of it. You're like, oh, well, what?
Stinks for all of them that just came out.
Right? But every slave that is bought for money may eat of it after you've circumcised him. No foreigner or hired worker may eat of it. And again, you're like, oh, man, what do we do with this? It shall be eaten in one house, and you shall not take any of the flesh outside the house, and you shall not break any of its bones, which, by the way, Jesus, one of the prophecies about him on the cross is he shall have no bones broken. Guess where that comes from? The Passover lamb cannot have its bones broken. All the congregation of Israel shall keep it. Now you get to verse 48 and you're like, wait a minute, because this seems to contradict. If a stranger, what's a stranger in Hebrew?
Foreigner.
It's a foreigner. Yeah. So if a foreigner shall sojourn with you and would keep the Passover to the Lord, let all of his males be circumcised. So now, wait a minute. It just said no foreigner will eat with you. But then it's saying if someone's going to sojourn with you and eat with you, let them be circumcised. So what is this all saying?
People have a path to become an Israelite.
That's right. If you're circumcised, you're no longer a foreigner. You've come into the family of faith. You're no longer a foreigner. You're one of us. You belong in the family of God. And so if you want to sojourn with us and leave with us and celebrate the Passover, you just have to be circumcised first. And so during the Passover offer, during this week of, you know, here come the lambs on Nisan 10, like,
a lot happened.
You got some stuff to do, right? If you want to be in. So then he may come near and keep it. He shall be as a native of the land. So he's going to be one of us. No uncircumcised person shall eat of it. There shall be one law. Hear this. Equality. It's not like one's better than the other. There shall be one law for the native and for the stranger who sojourns among you. Right? So we're all coming together. One law, one God. You find that same ethic in the New Testament. And now we're coming in for a close. Last verse. All the people. Last two verses. All the people of Israel did just as the Lord commanded Moses and Aaron. And on that very day, the Lord brought the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt by their hosts. So I know this is a long chapter, a lot of verses. What do we learn in this chapter? We learn that God is supreme over all gods and idols. There's no man who sets himself against us. There's no idols. There's no gods that are above him or even alongside of him. We learn that God is supreme over all earthly powers. We learn that God's judgment, though very patient, is real and eventually comes. We learn that God himself provides a refuge for people. We learn that a substitutionary sacrifice must die so that we can live. We learn that God's redeemed become a brand new people with a brand new beginning and a new calendar and a new fate and a new nation. We learn that all the nations are invited into his covenant promises, and he shows no favoritism to those who come. Like, right?
Yeah.
Whatever nation, if you're in, you're mine. And we learn that God protects his people by his very own presence. And we learn that the only thing that spares us from death, a deserved death, is what? Blood. So, end with an appeal. You know, this is a story that's 1,400 years plus before Jesus and 2,000 years from Jesus to us. So we're talking 3,400 years ago. This is celebrated and God is preaching a message. There is power in the blood. There is salvation in the blood. You have a God who loves you, who redeems you, who's come to break down your idols and to take away the things that enslave you. And the way to him is by the blood. That's it. And when you come in, you start dealing with the leaven in your life.
Yeah.
Stop being puffed up. Live for him. Humble yourself before God and man. Live a life that's eternally meaningful. There is so much in the Passover, and we're just scratching the surface of it right now. But that's at least what we've learned in Exodus 11 and 12.
Yep.
Sounds a lot like Jesus, right? Who is going to be slain on the night of his Passover. He's betrayed, tried, taken to a cross. And by the way, the day of his resurrection is another feast that's called the Feast of First Fruits. And you'll find in the New Testament that Jesus is called the firstborn of the dead, first fruits of the dead. Like this whole story, as we'll see even more as we go through the Red Sea, it's so good, is telling, it's pointing you, it's singing about Jesus in a way that when you lay them side by side, you see that Jesus accomplished something far greater than Moses ever dreamed. So we're going to stop there. I want to thank you so much for watching this episode of The Bible Show. Join us next time as we get into Israel's march out of Egypt and the crossing of the Red Sea, which is stunning and awesome. God bless. Thanks for listening to The Bible Show. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to like and subscribe and leave a kind review to help us in the world of tech algorithms. Also, feel free to share with a friend. We'll see you next week with another episode of The Bible Show.